Hey everyone, welcome back to the Gary V Audio Experience. In today's episode, Gary speaks at the annual SANS Leadership Lecture, giving his wisdom on what makes a great leader. We hope you enjoy.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Gary, you take it from here, and I'm very excited to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Richard. Everybody, I'm so honored to be here. You're hearing it right now. Out of nowhere, a little construction work has popped up in my building. So I apologize, but I think at this point, we've all got very accustomed to all these noises and sounds. So, you know, it's interesting, as Richard was talking, and as I think about the Q&A with my man O here in a little bit, I actually think the reason that I'm excited to get to the Q&A part so much is because that's how I think about leadership, that really it's a game of listening. Really, it's a game of almost opposite of what everybody thinks. I have, the timing of this talk is quite interesting because I'm writing a book that's coming out in November, December, and it's titled 12 and a half. And it talks about the 12 and a half ingredients that I go to the spice rack on when I create meals in my day-to-day decision-making, my investing, my operations. Today, I'm at the head of a 1,200 person global company called VaynerX with a lot of agencies and publishers and companies. And I'm just so excited to be here because I think all of us, as we get, you know, gray hairs start to come in, we start to get a better sense of ourselves. And I always think about what comes natural versus what is forced. And for me, emotional intelligence that I derived 100% from my mother from a DNA standpoint, but then also had the great luxury of being the oldest son and to Tamara Vaynerchuk. Not only that, I had the luxury of being an immigrant that came from the old country that is, you know, someone who sits with you today and can taste what it felt like to live in a studio apartment with multiple family members, to be in a place where I didn't have a lot of toys, to be in a place where I, you know, by 10 or 11, basically lived in a mindset of, well, if I want money, I have to get it myself. It's not going to be something that my parents go out and buy for me. But then also somebody who's the byproduct of a parent who built incredible self-esteem in me, confidence, but also balanced that with humility and accountability. Every good thing that's happened in my life, it's very easy for me to see, is the byproduct of my parenting. And then my aforementioned father, Sasha, who went from being a stock boy to owning a liquor store in New Jersey, Richard, for context, not New York, you know, taught me something that my mother couldn't. And honestly, the book is called 12 and a half because this is still a half ingredient for me because I'm not there yet. The value of candor, which I struggle with because ironically, if you watch me on videos on the internet, I have a lot of energy and I can be quite candorous. And I will be in this talk, but on a one-to-one level as a leader, I've always struggled with confrontation and delivering bad news, which unfortunately is part of the equation. And more importantly, if you ask me what a leader's job is, it is for her or him to eliminate fear from its team. And I do that by being accountable. I do that by innovating. I do that by putting up wins on the board. I definitely do that by leaning into things like empathy and compassion and sympathy, which I think are incredibly important ingredients to leadership that are not being taught as hard skills. And I believe that they're all the hardest of them all, like negotiation ability or conviction or, you know, sharp elbows are incredibly valuable. I am comfortable in telling you that I believe they are less valuable than being accountable, less valuable than being kind to the people you work with, less valuable than having the ability to suffocate bad politics and choosing the culture and the happiness of the collective over an executive who disproportionately is the best salesperson. Playing long-term heart instead of short-term wallet. So I'm in this very interesting place at 45 years old. You know, at 22 years old, I took over the lead role at my dad's business. And, you know, I built that business from a $3 to $65 million business with no cash infusion over a 6-year period. I started VaynerMedia 12 years ago, no cash infusion, first client paying us $60K, me and my brother, and it's now $250 million business in revenue in 12 years. And I was a wine shop owner going into Madison Avenue, selling social media, something nobody wanted or believed in and still actually don't understand. So I've been able to innovate and win and lead a lot of people. I've amassed tens of millions of followers on social media, not out of being attractive, not out of being great at sports, not out of singing or having a comedic or acting talent. It's been out of me sharing the wisdom that was naturally in my DNA and the incredible parenting that I was given, and then 20 years of trial and error and understanding, you know, what it takes to lead. You know, I think there's a couple things that I would love for all of you to hear, whether you work at Constellation, whether you're a student, and from the Honorable Dean down. Every single thing that you ever lead in your life that is wrong is 100% your fault. And so that's a very exciting and important starting point. And by the way, I noticed Kate just posted in here, I'm a big feedback leader. So I love the idea of the chat being active. As a matter of fact, to just spark it off, because I need the energy and I love it. Let's go old school America Online. You know, for some of the youngsters in here, you're not gonna know what I mean by this, but ASL, age, sex, location. Give me a little context of who's in the room. Where are you? Where do you live? Just to get that flow going, because really what I wanna get that flow going with is, and please do it right now, is I wanna get the conversation flow going, because I also want you to really ask these questions. And because I think that in the macro, what I'm about to talk about is very, 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 it's all going in the Q&A here, not in the chat. Very nice. I see. This is where the age, sex, location thing is. So it's in my Q&A, not the chat. I love it. Joe from New York gets me excited. Stephanie from Chicago, very good. Jennifer from Rochester, I love it. All right, so I'll put this over here because it's not in chat, it's in the Q&A, beautiful. So Rafa from Orlando, big shout out. Sorry, I get a little sidetracked. This is my creative style. So it's really exciting, everybody, for you to understand this truth, because it's actually true. In a private enterprise, even with all the external realities, if you lose your biggest client and then have to fire everyone, well, then you allowed your biggest client to represent too big of a percentage of your company. When I started my client service business, to this day, nobody represents more than 15% of my business, just not a meaningful enough one that puts me in a vulnerable spot. Yet I see people that run client service businesses have Constellation or Nike or BMW or somebody as their biggest client. And then when they lose them, they blame everybody else except themselves. Every day, every time we land a very large client, I then basically spend all my energy on making sure that I go and land 2 to 3 other big clients to round that out, because I'm worried about the vulnerability. I'm worried about the vulnerability. And so, you know, when 3 people quit in the media team because the head of your media person, or 6 people in HR quit because your head of HR, or 1 person quits because of your CFO, like, you've hired all those leaders. I've hired every single person in my company, whether I've done it directly or I hired the person that hired them. I promise you, the quickest way to be excited, happy, wake up in the morning with vigor, enjoy it, not burn out, and not be anxious about these incredible ambitions that sit in all of your bodies, of your next steps, professionally and personally for that matter, the number one way to be at peace is around accountability. When you go into blame game, you are vulnerable. And I couldn't, and I mean couldn't, push this more. And when I see Matt Mazza say accountability is contagious, if leaders show they're accountable, then everyone, it's absolutely true, Matt. The more accountable I've become, and I started very accountable and I just kept compounding because I reinforced things that were good and I try to work on things that weren't good. I mean, it's crazy. And by the way, people are also incredibly appreciative of an accountable leader. Even if they don't have the stomach at that point in their life to be accountable, they have much more compassion for a leader that is accountable, outwardly accountable. This is a very, very major thing that I want to start with, and I really wanted to put on everyone's radar. Number two, the ability to be gray versus black and white. You are in a school system right now or a corporation. By nature, a lot of the games that you're playing are literal. They're very black and white. They're tangible. They're data driven. And I actually am very scared of that for all the people here if they actually want to be leaders. The great role of a leader is for her or his ability to see the unseen, for them to see things that other people don't, for them to have the bravery and conviction to try new things that aren't obvious, to lead its organization to 2023 instead of using 2019 as a proxy for 2023. This, as you can imagine, bravery, vision, the ability to see the gray instead of the black is very important, because what ends up happening is what makes that very easy to do is the ability to not be scared when you fail, because you're leaning on accountability, right? And so I'm a very big fan of leadership being around the gray, right? If the world was black and white, if the world was math, if the world was school books, well, then everything would be figured out. We would be just fine. The reality is that what you need to be doing when you're an incredible organization like this, when you're at an amazing institution like the school that you're at, of course you should extract the tangible black and white literal variables, but they become commoditized extremely quickly, right? They become commoditized very fast. And what you learn, and I've had the great fortune of being around incredible leaders in my life, is it's not just a natural DNA trait that some people are just born leaders. It's that many people are born leaders, but their parenting, schooling, neighborhood, culture, environment lead with fear, and they get boxed in. They become fear-based. They think downside. They don't breathe. They were predisposed DNA-wise to potentially be a leader, but fear, being scared, defense became their environment. And I've always found that those individuals are actually incredibly capable after a 5 to 10 year osmosis, living in a cocoon of optimism, practical optimism. I think optimism, you want to talk about a trait that dominates to win it in leadership, it's optimism, but it's practical optimism, right? When you stay in a practical, optimistic place, you don't do high risk behavior. You do strategic risk behavior that tends to work. And I think practical optimism is something I'd love for everybody. And again, what I want to do here, because I know me and O are about to do incredible Q&A, and I think that's where the magic's going to come from, but I'm trying to give you some of the ingredients. Curiosity, please. One of the things I worry about with highly intelligent, well-accomplished, academic-based winners, like many of you, is the elimination of youth and curiosity. I think one of the great things about a leader is her humility or his humility in their curiosity, the ability to go and try new things, to balance. I mean, I spend an incredible amount of juxtaposition between conviction and curiosity. I have them both so equally and so passionately, yet they can rear their heads in different scenarios and they don't look like teammates. They look like contradictions, but they are not. This incredible blend of conviction and curiosity, I think, is incredibly important. And so You know, I think, you know, Zach, I'm just going to answer your question right now. It already caught me. How do you lead from a position of weakness? Say you're not the head of an organization or an executive. You lead by communicating the truth with kindness, kind candor, Zach. You say what you see in the trenches, but you say it in a non-disrespectful, not hypocritical, not you like blaming or pointing fingers. You know, you communicate it to everybody from HR to the C-suite leadership. And if they are not in the business of listening to that, well, then that's given you a feedback indicator that maybe this isn't the place for you. But I noticed that many people would rather dwell in their realities and blame the machine without actually having the kind, candor conversation. I think the determination and tenacity matter. You know, I don't understand the concept of giving up, because I also live in a world that I think other leaders live in, which is not being able to hear the outside affirmation or pushback. The reason I have tenacity and determination is I'm playing this game for me. I'm doing this for me, for me. So I don't give up because I like it. I'm in it for the journey, not for the bonus. If you want to be a leader because you want to get the financial compensation that comes along with leadership, you're going to be bad. I'm just very comfortable saying that. If your core KPI is the stock price, the IPO, how much you'll make on the SPAC, what your salary is, if that's, and by the way, those are important things. There's nothing wrong with that. But if that is your, if that is your game, you will struggle. As Rushi says, how do you one figure out the difference between hustle and burnout? It's very easy. I work a lot of hours, but my anxiety levels are zero and I sleep like a rock because I'm not in it for the money or the accolades. And I don't spend my money to impress others. So I save money. So if God forbid all my businesses go out of business, I'll have to downgrade my homes, but I'll still be able to live a comfortable life. And whether that's a millionaire or a 100,000-aire, those are realistic things. The problem is most people get to burnout because they don't know how to manage their money. They overspend. They overspend. Compassion matters to me. There's a saying that I believe in more than anything, which is there's two ways to build the biggest building in town. If you want to build a big business or a big legacy or a big nonprofit or a big political career, there's two ways. One, you just go out and build the biggest business. Two, you tear down everybody else's building. So for me, I watch a lot of leaders and I notice that a lot of people lead from tearing down everything around them. They win by default. By tearing everything else down, they're the last building standing. I think this is a very lonely and very short-term success track. I'm a big fan of just going out there and trying to build the biggest building. And if somebody happens to build a bigger building because they are more talented or more strategic, I'm not a cheerleader to my competitor, but I absolutely acknowledge and respect that execution. And spending any energy on trying to tear down or undermining them instead of trying to figure out how to get to my place and do it better seems like a wasted energy. You know, I think that there are a lot of things out there that matter, but I believe one of the greatest traits for a leader is patience. I am stunned by people's inability to be patient. I have a lot of compassion for Richard, who's lived a life where he's had to be successful according to Wall Street every 90 days. It's very hard to be patient in that environment. School, every report card. I'm fascinated by the business world's evolution into being school and vice versa. Every 90 days being judged by numbers is the quickest way to not build something meaningful. It is transactional by nature. I think it's a huge mistake. And I think the only shot that I would ever have to be a public CEO would be to have incredible, unheard of, revolutionary control over the board and my ability to drive my business in 30-year terms instead of 30-day terms. Patience is an incredible attribute. When you have empathy and patience, you're able then to lead people that work for you or underneath you. You know, this is a one big game of balancing contradictory energies, having ambition, which I believe in the most, and having patience seem at opposites, but they're incredibly easy to balance when you lean into patience. When you're thinking you're playing in perpetuity, the game changes very quickly. I can tell you right now, I could say one little sentence here, and I think I'm going to do that. And I think we should open up to Q&A because I think we'll get all the other things I'd want to talk about in more direct detail. I'm going to leave you with this and then we'll go into Q&A. I'm going to give you a sentence or two right now that I genuinely believe will make most of you better leaders. If you are living your life for outside affirmation, how big is your house? What car do you drive? When someone Googles your name, what does it say for net worth? With the watch you wear, the sneakers you go with, the plus one on your hand. You will always, always be vulnerable as a leader. When you are in a binary cocoon in your own mind of not needing outside affirmation, but enjoying what you do and getting selfish energy out of being selfless to your team first and then to your customers and then thinking about yourself third, you now have the formula for incredible leadership. I believe this last century was focused on becoming more literal, becoming modern. Process and practicality were put on a pedestal, efficiency. Then we demonized intuition and Eastern medicine and the power of the brain and superstitions and Zen. I believe over the next 100 years, we will see the rise of emotional intelligence as the leading indicator around leadership and business. That words like empathy and sympathy and courage and curiosity and accountability and lack of entitlement and not getting high on your own supply and not reading your headlines and not thinking you're fancy, humility, will become the core things that we teach and have aspirations for people that are gangster business women and men. That is my great belief. And so that's what I have to share. Thank you. The chat is on. I think we're ready.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Gary. That was pretty awesome. I'm like, you know, frantically scribbling notes. Make sure I got it all down, and I'm sure a lot of people felt the same way. So my name is Adochi Wazirike. I am a first year MBA candidate here at Simon, a Fielding Leadership Fellow. I'm excited to be moderating the question and answer part. I was monitoring the Q&A and you guys have been, you know, very enthusiastic with your questions. So I'll start it off with a question from a current student and a first year classmate of mine, Christian Stewie. And his question is, how do you build the self-esteem in your team members and help maximize their potential as a leader?
Adochi, you keep yourself on the, because I like bantering a little bit. So keep yourself off mute if you don't mind. And I love your suit, by the way. So please go on mute because I want to kind of go back and forth with you. There's a reason. Actually, Adochi, can you go on mute? Because I want to ask you this. Do you know why in modern times, when there is a coup in a country, why the army first goes and attacks the media outlets instead of the palace?
So that they can block off all channels of communication and people can't know what's going on.
Comma, they want to be on the offense to control the message instead of the reverse. The way you build self-esteem in your people is by communication. When Sally does something well, you tell them. When Adochi wears an epic suit and gave a great thought, you tell them. My great misstep in my career has been the inability to tell them, Adochi, you were brilliant in that meeting. Adochi, this PowerPoint's off. You missed their question. I would kind of finagle it and take the lead. I overcoddled. One of the reasons I have very aggressive points of view on modern parenting is I was able to parallel it with the way that I was misstepping as a manager, and that entitlement through blind bullshit self-esteem building, which isn't self-esteem building, it's delusion building, created children that are unable to stand on their own two feet and unable to deal with a lot of variables. So the way to build self-esteem is to disproportionately pat on the back when it's true, but also have the ability to give candor in a kind form that makes the Adochi in that situation understand, oh, Gary's not just gassing me up all the time. He's willing to give me some feedback, and then your compliments will land. And that's what my mother did for me, but I did not do as well as a leader. I would be around the bush and then I would just fire people and they'd be stunned, which led to fear. This is why I have such a conviction around this, because I've lived the good and the bad version of it. That is the answer to that question. You've got to compliment your people. People don't compliment. My dad didn't compliment his employees because he thought they would ask for raises if he did. And I think a lot of organizations take on that subculture and that belief. And that's what I mean by the change of EQ versus black and white. I think we became so finance driven in the last 100 years that that sentiment actually exists.
I think that's a great response, and that leads to our next question. I know you mentioned that EQ and emotional intelligence, you see that as being the future characteristics by which leaders will be judged. So there's a question here from Brandon, and his question is, how do you create a culture where your employees feel comfortable opening up emotionally and maybe exhibiting and or you know being able to grow in their emotional intelligence?
Easy. It's by your actions. It's very, very, very easy if you back up your intent with action. When let me answer that question in this form. This is an email that was just sent right before I got on here. Jess Valley sent this at 12 p.m., 36 minutes ago. As some of you may know, after 7+ wonderful years, today is my last day at Vayner. I'm going to skip everything here because I want to be here, but I want to say this. Deciding to leave VaynerMedia was incredibly difficult. Most people do not have the privilege of loving what they do, who they do it with, or who they work for. Gary has built something wonderful here, an organization you can see, be heard, and cared for. Please take advantage of his open door policy. Express what's on your mind. I promise you won't regret it. The single biggest reason my original quote of, I doubt I'll stay at this company for more than 1 year, turned into 8 years, was because of what Gary exhibited to me one-on-one in our one-on-ones. That. It's very easy to do it. People will open up to you when they open up to you that you act like a human, not a robotic corporate machine that cares about money at all costs. Got it?
I think that's, that makes sense. It's very, very simple.
The simplicity of humanity is incredible. The execution of deploying the best human traits is unfortunately difficult for many.
That's good. Another question here in the chat. And it's, what?
Real quick, I apologize. The anonymous attendee that says self-esteem building is great, but I feel that we're in a narcissism epidemic. The general opinion is that social media is to blame. As a leader, how do you deal with narcissists, either above or below you in an organization? From my experience, if you handle this incorrectly, these individuals will often become arch enemy number one, which can affect the success of your firm. Blaming social media for our incredible lack of accountability and our forever narcissism. Why do you think a capitalist country like America buys unlimited things? It's all based on narcissism. Social media is just exposing us. It hasn't changed us, Odoji. You know what I mean? This is just exposing us. It's easy and lazy because of the collective lack of accountability for us to blame social media. The way you deal with a narcissist is kind candor. The reason most people struggle with a narcissist within an organization is they have pent up resentment for their poor behavior. And the first time they communicate their feelings towards that person, it comes from a place of blowing up or at wit's end. when you come to that person halfway through your observation with compassion and empathy, that the reason they're being a narcissist is they're probably compensating for a very difficult childhood variable, all of a sudden you're coming from a place of kindness and from a place of comfort instead of from a place of combativeness. The reason most people have bad relationships with narcissists was they were unable to communicate with them in a way of empathy or compassion. The words I'm talking about in here as a leader means that you have to deploy them when it's hard. The biggest confusion for everybody on this Zoom right now is being a leader is easy when everything's going well. I'm asking you to be the bigger person in every situation in perpetuity. When somebody stole $250,000 worth of wine from me and my father, my dad reacted with rage and like borderline things that would put you in jail. I acted with deep concern to why that person would even do that, because we knew them, which later became true that they got hurt on the job, which they blamed subconsciously on us, and became addicted to painkillers deeply, and then got into a place where they couldn't afford their lifestyle and needed to start stealing to pay for their painkillers. When you come from a place of empathy and compassion on your first reaction, dealing with a narcissist actually becomes incredibly easy because you feel bad for them, not the way they make you feel.
Wow, that's insightful. And I think we'll stick with the social media topic. We have a question here where it's he's mentioned that you previously discussed the importance of harnessing personal and human interaction. And how do you manage taking on that challenge effectively while leveraging social media as a tool?
One more time, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little distracted with the questions. That's my fault, go ahead.
So I'm sticking with the social media topic.
Yep.
They said that we've highlighted today the importance of harnessing personalized human interaction.
Yes.
How can you manage that challenge and effectively leverage social media to do so? Or as I'm going to say, how can you do that in this social media landscape that we operate in?
By falling in love with the word both and versus the obsession in modern times of the word or. I do not understand why people think that because we live in a digital world, that means you have to pick between digital and real life. The answer is and. I have incredible scale of human interaction because I use digital as a gateway drug to create it. I'm using digital right now to build relationships. Adochi, you and I right now have a new relationship. I have a photographic memory. I know you. I'm interacting with you. We now have a different relationship than we did before. I didn't need to meet you for a beer or shake your hand or look you in the fucking eye. You know, like we have these ideologies of the past. This is a very easy answer. Using modern technology to scale human interaction. I do tons of human interaction and I do tons of it with context because I use modern technology because we're just communicating on it. What is the difference between a computer screen and a piece of paper? We put letters on a pedestal, but not digital screens. We have an incredible ability to demonize technology and to look at the past as romance. I think it's a humongous human flaw that leads to limitations. It's fear-based. And I think it's oftentimes what leads to some of the worst behavior. Us blaming social media for everything right now is the biggest problem we have.
Yeah,
I just want to remind everybody, the algorithms are empty. The pipes are empty. There's no social media. That's you. You're looking at yourself.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. We have a question here. When this is more about like finding talent and recruiting. And they said, how do you identify individuals who will also have empathy such as yourself? Or
we do it in a very specific way. We make our interview process amazingly, dramatically candorous around how much we care about it. I even say at the highest levels, the C-suite and the SVPs, EVPs that I interview, I tell them that if you're insecure, this is an incredibly good time to opt out or to tell me so that we can overcompensate and help you. Because if you're insecure, it is going to lead to the kind of behavior that get you fired here. Do not get it twisted. I don't care how many clients you get for us or how much revenue you are attached to, if you are not capable of being nice and a good person to the people that you work with, you will get fired. What that does is it starts conviction, Adochi, at the top when we start with people, which is a huge game because it almost scares people that know they're political animals to not go all the way with us. Or it's ones that think they're clever and they think it's lip service. And I'm just saying it for optics because I'm Gary Vee or every company says that. I usually within the first 4 to 6 months will sit down with them and say, we're at the final line now. I go right to it. I'm like, I told you. We've had 3 people quit in the first 6 weeks that you've been here. Like, what do you think is going on? You know, and I think a lot of people think they can trick me. And I think that's what everybody here needs to work on, which is tell the people you're interviewing the conviction. And then I have a thesis that's a little bit different than most. Hire fast when you're growing. Fire faster. Hiring, Adochi, is guessing. Firing is knowing. Hiring is guessing. Too many people have their ego wrapped up in being good hirers. I have incredible EQ. I've been tricked a million times. Hiring is guessing. Firing is knowing. So hire fast, fire faster, and give promotions and raises fastest. So when you hire someone, you're guessing. If somebody comes in and they've got it, you should go into promotion cycle, not 1 year, 2 year, or a raise, or a meaningful conversation of I've got my eye on you. And on the flip side, if they're poor, you got to go into like, we told you in the upfront, so this is your warning. This is not going to be some sort of long-winded process. Your humanity matters here. We've had an incredible media executive in Singapore that's already gone, resigned last night. And seemed like that should not be the case, but it was because we suffocated what we care about.
Wow. I think the hire fast, fire faster, and promotions fastest, that's something that's going to stick with a lot of future leaders here on this call. I'm going to pivot a little bit and get in a quick, fun question because I know everyone knows about your love for the Jets.
I apologize, Adochi. Real quick.
Go ahead.
Can you read Akun's question? The Gary's concept is pretty new to me, and this is quite different from all I have seen in several companies I've worked for, where everything is fully transactional from an appraisal. The concept of the winner takes all, leaders who tear down others' efforts to be at the forefront. In as much as I really like Gary's concept, my question is, has this been tested in organizations and can it really work? The answer is yes. I have a company that does $250 million in revenue. That is not consolation, but that is not zero and it's only a decade old. Remember when I spoke about leaders have to see the future, not look at the past? My greatest promise to myself at this point is to rewrite the humanity that it requires to become a complete iconic empire building mogul. My company terminology inside of VaynerMedia is we're building the honey empire. Honey over vinegar, but we're building an empire. The answer is yes, that absolutely can be done. If the leader has control and she or he is more motivated by the mission than the financial impact. I leave tens of millions of dollars in profit on the table each year to make billions of dollars in profit in 26 years when I'll just be 71 years young. Of course this will work. We're writing it right now.
Building on that, we have a question here from the Bennett Career Center. Shout out to them, doing great work, the Bennett Career
Center. Bennett.
And so their question is, the University of Rochester's motto is Meliora, which means ever better. But when is something ever good enough?
Both. I think things are good enough always, to be honest. I think people are very confused. Everybody, there's only one judge and jury, which is the collective market, right? What I see is ego and politics and insecurity make subjective calls of better or good enough. Without that output, seeing the light of day, a winemaker deciding that the blend is not good enough yet. We need another 30 days. An advertising executive saying the video isn't funny enough. We have to wait. A product lead. I see it every day. Leaders in companies making egotistical, subjective political decisions to maintain their status instead of realizing the market's going to decide. And the quicker we can get this to market, the quicker we can actually get feedback to then make adjustments. I think good enough is one of the greatest things in the world, because I think good enough is actually a subjective opinion within boardrooms. And the only time better, good enough, great, or sucky actually play out is when the consumer gets to taste it.
No, yeah, that's good. A question for you from someone who's international. They said they're from a country outside of the US. How do you work to be mindful to make sure that you're perceived as empathetic? And I'll say we've learned in class that's, you know, some countries are not obviously quite as emotional, whether in business or in personal interaction. So how do you maybe make up for that gap?
By being the energy of change. Just because parts of Asia or Europe, I mean, I have offices in Mexico City, Australia, all throughout Southeast Asia, Europe, LA and New York are different, my man. You know, big shout out to my East Coast New York energy. Like, I love all of my Cali executives, but it's different. Not just throwing down some bars. Every culture, subculture, every organization is different. You don't need to go to different countries by being the advocate of change. Just because your oversensitivity may not land in mainland China doesn't mean it's not right. Doesn't mean it's not right. I really think there's an accountability layer of like, I promise you this, there's nothing good about the following narrative. Oh, Gary, you don't get it. My company's office is in Shanghai and everyone's cutthroat. So that's why I had to be like that. You mean you compromised your humanity for a bag? Adochi, think about what we're talking about here. Gary, you don't get it. I get it all the time. I'm reading all these comments. I get DMs. I get bombarded on. For everybody here, here is my handle in most platforms, Gary VEE. You can hit me up. You can follow like LinkedIn. I'm the third most consumed person on the platform. Like, you'll see me and I get nothing. You don't get it. You don't get it. You're naive. And I'm like, no, you're naive. What you just told me in the scenario that you just told me is that you were willing to compromise your humanity and soul for your paycheck. I think that's ludicrous. And please don't even come at me with any word that thinks that you're a leader if you're doing that. Be the fucking change.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I think that's straightforward and nice, right? Someone said,
real quick, Jeremy says, do you ever feel or worry that your candor can be intimidating? How do you create self-awareness? Jeremy, yes, which is why at VaynerX, I created the term for my team called kind candor. Like Jeremy, you know, giving people feedback, critical feedback or radical candor. I think that people misunderstand this. It usually, Jeremy, is an opportunity for permission to not be kind or to get some of your resentment or frustration out on another human being that you have political power on. It's devastating. We must come with our candor with compassion and empathy and sympathy. I don't know what's going on. What if Adoch is killing it, but now he's all of a sudden, he's just not been strong and we just gave him a promotion. It might not be just that he leveled up and he's calibrating. His grandma might be sick. I don't know. But every time I think that first, not, oh, he just got a raise and he didn't think he had a, like, people are cynical. We need to eliminate cynicism. Everyone's so cynical. We're talking about leadership here today, right? This is leadership talk. I'm showing you, I'm talking to you right now about leadership. Leadership is not the academia. Leadership is not the tangible. Leadership is around humanity. Humanity.
Yeah, that's good. And I'll transition to actually a great follow-up question here from Paul, where it says, if you're following this, you know, tension between long-term heart and short-term wallet. And he said, mm-hmm. But how do you know when your heart is calibrated to maximize the benefit? And how do you know that?
You don't. everybody, one thing I've learned about you students is you want to know everything because that's how you reverse engineer to get good grades and get good stock results. You think I knew COVID was coming to Doge? You think I knew, you think somebody who had a tree fall on them knew? You think the person that, you know, knew that their husband was going to be terminally ill? You think people knew that they bought some Bitcoin by accident 6 years ago for 12,000 bucks because they were drunk one night and their tech friend told them to, and now it's worth 12 million? Like, you want to know something about leadership, my friends? It's getting really, really, really comfortable with knowing you don't know, which gets me to the point. You want to be a great leader? Love what you do. Love what you do. I promise you, love what you do. This is real stuff. This is real stuff. Andrea, thank you for what you said. This is about parenting, leadership. You don't know anything. Why do you think all of us are so scared when we have kids? Because you know you don't know. You want to be a great leader? We're talking leadership now, not successful careers. If we're talking leadership, please, my friends, listen to my conviction, because this is the purest form of this in communication form right now. I'm very comfortable in saying that. I've hit it. I've got my moment right now. Get comfortable with the idea of not knowing anything, but being prepared for everything. I don't know anything other than I am prepared. I knew that I was going to slay my company during COVID. Here's what happened. We have debt. I've been running the company for 3 straight years without profit. Talk about something that would get me fired, Adoge, if I had to answer to anybody. And COVID hits, and in 48 hours, my 6 biggest clients call me and tell me they're going to be delaying payment. And I'm scared. Like, it's COVID. Like, I'm scared. My parents, kids, like, I'm scared. What transpired over the last year since then is the company has exploded to new heights that it's never seen before. I didn't know it was coming. I was just mentally, in my heart and my brain, ready for it. Emotionally, foundationally ready for it. You don't know anything. How do you know? You don't know. But if the journey is your gift, not that you're going to take it to $1 trillion, well, then you've won.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think this year has illustrated to everyone that, like you said, we don't know everything. Time and time
again. I apologize. Imposter syndrome in the starting of your careers, there's a really good way. Don't put other people on a pedestal. I always tell my team, all my accomplishments, the way I communicate, all this stuff, I'm nobody. I disappear tomorrow, it's over. Nobody cares. The way to not feel like an imposter is by not putting other people on a pedestal. You're just starting out. You're not supposed to know anything. Enjoy the process. The problem is it's very hard to get out of the judgment every 90-day game that so many of us are in.
Okay. I know we're coming up on time, so I will get in one quick question for all the Jets fans who we know are on the call. One question was, when you finally, you know, get ownership of the Jets, how are you going to build the culture to be an empathetic culture, and how are you going to make sure they win a Super Bowl?
One of the great reasons I want to buy the Jets and win a Super Bowl is by that time, that means that I've built a $1 billion business ecosystem, which led me to that moment. Then I go take the Jets, who at that point still may be historically bad, and win a Super Bowl. And then as a 95-year-old, when I talk about the things I talked about here, right? Kindness, empathy, patience, accountability, genuine love and curiosity for your fellow woman and man. These real things, practical optimism, eliminating cynicism, not trying to get us to feel separate, but getting us integrated. If I do all the things you just asked, Adoji, then I think my words will carry more weight. To the question earlier of that person that asked, if I do it, well, then it becomes a blueprint. So when I tell you with every ounce of my soul, I am going to try to do this because I know I'm good. If nothing good happens to me financially or legacy-wise again, I've done a lot already. I've had a nice run. I'm happy. I enjoy the process. But I know if I pull off this audacity that I put into the universe and then layer it with the way I've been communicating about the things I talked about today and I do on a daily basis, that I can make an impactful change on the way that alpha, notice what I said, Adoji, alpha winners look at the world. And I'm really excited about it. A couple quick things, because you did a great job. Everyone's giving you love. Number one, the Bills Mafia guy, Bennett, I'm very upset about. I'm sure there's plenty of Bill Mafia here, given where we are. That's bothersome. Number two, I'm very humbled by how many of you know about my NFT drop on May 5th. It's coming. You'll see a bunch about that. Be ready. But you need to have Ethereum in your MetaMask ASAP if you want to participate, because that secondary market's going to be ugly. And number three, Mr. Sands, thank you so much. Dean, thank you so much. I'm incredibly flattered to be a part of this today.
Wow. Well, Gary, you've taught us a lot. I could sit here for hours. I watch many of your talks and Q&As on YouTube and other places. And it was a pleasure to see you and answer your questions in real time. This was an amazing opportunity. And I wanted to thank Richard Sands and Sands Family Foundation and Constellation Brands for your support of this series and making the Simon School ever better. Meliora. Thank you to our alumni, students, and prospective students for joining us today. And to my students, prospective or here, be curious, be courageous, compassionate, comfortable with gray, patient, and accountable, as Gary has said, and love what you do.
Life is because you can, yes. Dean. You and I, less. This internet thing, these kids like Adoji and all these wonderful kids in here, the internet has made it practical to be able to first try to do something you love. You can always settle at 40, at 36, at 52 on getting a job. It is now practical to take at bats at something you're interested in. And if you really then also understand being happy every day and making $137,000 a year versus being very unhappy and making $219,000, especially if you spend money on wise things instead of trying to impress others, it becomes an ecosystem of winning.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dean. Bye, everyone. As we end today's podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to the people, you know, it's so funny, people that leave reviews and written reviews of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms just mean the world to me. You've taken an extra 13 to 95 seconds to show love and also give context to people of why this is a worthwhile podcast. So I appreciate that so much. And even more fun, because I think we all love a little cosign or a shout out or a little awareness, I'm gonna have the team give a couple of shout outs daily on our favorite reviews. So take it away, which were our favorites this week?
Thanks, Gary. Today's amazing five-star review reads, deep breath. Gary and team, thank you for everything you do. This podcast inspires, moves, and challenges me big. It reminds me of my greatness and to get it done. Thank you so much for that generous review. And to anybody listening out there, if you leave us one, you might just get shouted out in the next episode.